This is a neat time of year, and there's a lot going on. Next week, it has occurred to us we have not mentioned this, and it's kind of a big deal. Next Sunday, we're going to honor our high school graduates. We have quite a few of them. They're listed on the front page of this week's bulletin. And a part of honoring them is going to include a fellowship meal. I told you this was really important. So I want you to plan for that, not only to support that with food, but also with your presence. And that will be followed by a 1 p.m. worship service instead of the 5 p.m. worship service. All right. So it occurred to me moments ago, and Bill and I exchanged our ministerial telepathy that we've developed. And so anyway, he said, mention it. And I said, I'm on it. Next Sunday, church eat church, as we call it, lunch followed by worship service. We will not be here this time next week because it's 1 p.m. instead of 5 to honor our high school graduates. Tonight also marks the last Sunday, really, that the Fried Hardeman students are with us. Finals week this week, graduation on Saturday. And we just want you all to know, as you're scattered around here and there, how special you are to us and how much you mean to the congregation here. We try to communicate how valuable your contributions are to the life of this church, and we pray that we can make a valuable impact on you as well during your time here. And we wish you the very best this week. And we also realize that there are some students who, for whatever reason, feel the need to graduate and therefore to move on from Henderson. And so we may not get to see you as much. Don't be strangers. Come back and visit, but we're going to miss you. And if there's some way we can help you or assist you, please let us know. It seems like an appropriate time to think about the promises of God. You know, Christians react to difficulty and trials differently than the rest of the world. For example, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, Paul says, I don't want you to be unlearned, brothers, concerning those who have fallen asleep. Now, he's speaking of death, but he uses that wonderful New Testament way of speaking about Christians who have departed this life as being asleep. He says, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. You see, we deal with things differently because we have a hope. We view this life as not the be-all and end-all. Certainly, this life is important, but it's preparing us for the next. Our hope is anchored there, where our Savior is. And we long to be there with Him in heaven. That hope that we have, of course, is deeply rooted in the promises that He has made to us. I don't know what this summer is going to hold for you. Many of us will continue onward as we do during the school year, just with fewer people around town, I suppose. Some of you will depart and go back to your homes, and then you'll return here, the Lord willing, in August. And others of you, as mentioned, are graduating on into real life. And there, you'll begin your wonderful journey and your career. Life is different when we're apart than it is when we're together. We feel that separation. I remember missing seeing people during the summers when I was a student here. And when you get to come back and reunite, it's always a wonderful thing. Sometimes it just feels lonely, doesn't it? Even for those of us who aren't students, it certainly is great to be together, and I feel the separation, sometimes admittedly more than others, when we're not together. And isn't it wonderful to live in a small town? For those of you who have lived elsewhere, you can appreciate how nice it is to regularly run into those who are members of the Lord's church. Maybe even to get to work with those who are Christians and to have that regular interaction with those individuals. But sometimes, if Satan is doing his job the way that he hopes he is, we begin to feel isolated and lonely. And this evening, I want us to consider that idea from the positive in Psalm 139. Would you open to the 139th Psalm? And if you want an outline tonight, that's it right there in these 20-some-odd verses. From Psalm 139, we can cling to the promises of God when He tells us that we are, I'm using this in somewhat of a summary fashion, but that we are truly never alone. We're going to break this down into four parts as we make our way through this, but I don't have time to give you a really detailed exegesis of the 139th Psalm. There's just too much here. But let's dig in and see what we can glean. And my prayer is, looking at the promises of God will give us strength. For some of you, for a long, hard week of finals, followed by a summer that is away. And for all of us, strength for the journey, wherever life's going to take us in the coming week and the days ahead. First, let's look at the first six verses of Psalm 139. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. The tradition, according to the superscription before verse 1, is that David is the author of these words. And so, if that's correct, here's David. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand on me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high. I cannot attain it. As we look at the first section and observation of this psalm, I just want us to realize that God knows everything. Now, we're talking about some of the fundamental concepts of what makes God God, the attributes of God, that God is omniscient. And if you were to break down that word in just a super simple way, you see at the end of the word omniscience, you see the word science, which to me says things I know. Omni, all. God is all-knowing. God knows everything. And certainly the text before us bears that out. For example, in verse 2, he says, you know when I sit down and rise up. You discern my thoughts, even from afar. You search out my path and my lying down. Verse 4, even before I speak a word, God, you know it all together. It's true. God knows everything. But this evening, I want to encourage you to make it personal. Because it comes closer to home than that. Yeah, it's true. God knows everything about everything. There's nothing you can learn that you could teach to God. There's nothing new to Him. He's created it all. And even the things that we don't know about yet, God knows about them because He put them there. But the psalmist here in 139 not only points out that God knows everything, he says God knows everything about me. O Lord, you have searched me and known me, verse 1 says. Searched, a thorough examination, complete. If you're trying to have a thorough knowledge of whatever the subject matter is on the final exams that you have coming up, students, this week, you're not going to acquire that knowledge without significant effort, time, mental energy, even exhaustion. Anybody facing any all-nighters coming up in the near future? But God knows it all, and He knows it all without exhausting Him. God's exhaustive knowledge is not exhausting to Him. To have a thorough knowledge of every part of me, even down to the minute trivia of me. You know, I don't know how many hairs are on my head, other than the fact that it's less today than it was this time last year. All right. But God knows. To think that God knows everything, but He knows everything about me. He knows me better than I know myself. You have, look at the end of verse 1. You have known me. How many times today have you stood up or sat down? Well, several just in this worship service, right? While we stand and sing. It's not time for the sermon to be over yet. I don't know how many times I've gotten up and sat down today. But God does. You know when I rise up. I mean, the point of this seems to be even the common casual tasks of life. God knows. God notices. You see, I can't tell you how many times I've gotten up or sat down today because I don't really care, right? That's menial. I don't take note of that. I certainly can't tell you how many times you've gotten up or been seated today. But God notices the little things. And that's endearing. I suppose there's an aspect of God's omniscience that could cause me to get a little bit uncomfortable. I don't think that's where David is coming from here in Psalm 139. He seems to be talking about it as a comforting notion. The fact that God knows me and that God is very intimately acquainted with me is a wonderful thing to consider. However, if I'm reading this or I'm thinking about God's omniscience, and it makes me a little uncomfortable in the inside, that God even knows the secret things that I don't want anybody else in this room to find out, that could be a red flag of a spiritual problem. Something that I need to take care of with God. Or maybe even with another. God discerns my thoughts from afar. God not only knows the common casual tasks, He knows the thoughts that motivate my actions. He knows why I do what I do. Have you ever said it? Why did they do that? What were they thinking? Have you ever thought something like that? Or better yet, if you're like me, sometimes I say that about myself. Why did I do that? What was I thinking just then doing that? God knows not only what I do, but why I do what I do. And that's a comforting thought to me as I consider the fact that God is not going to misjudge me. He's not going to apply to me something that is not accurate about me. You know my path and my lying down. You know when I get up in the morning and when I go to bed at night. You're acquainted with all of my ways. Check this out, verse 4. Even before I say something, God knows what it is that I'm going to say. Sometimes I don't know what I'm going to say until it's too late. It's already out there. I wish I could reel it back in, right? God knows it. You hem me in behind and before. Hemming in, a protection. I can't drop back and lose God. And I can't run ahead forward and outrun Him. He's always there. And you know what that means? Nothing catches God off guard. Does anybody else find it ironic that in the year 2020, a lot of congregations and preachers were responsible, I think, for this, had these themes, you know, for the year in January of 2020, back in the day, you know. 2020 vision. We had no idea what was coming, did we? You know that phrase, hindsight is 2020? I don't think we're going to say that anymore because I don't want to see that in the rearview mirror, you know. God wasn't caught off guard by a global pandemic. He hasn't been caught off guard by any of the economic problems that have been experienced since or even to the present day. He knows it all. He's behind me and He's before me. And when there's a diagnosis that you weren't expecting, or when something in life doesn't go the way you planned it, even though it's news to you, it's not news to God. God knows. And God cares. There are things that you don't know because you don't care to know them, right? That's not my interest. I might learn it when I have to, and then I'll quickly forget it as soon as possible. That's not God. God is eagerly, excitedly interested in you. The psalmist begins by saying, God knows everything. He knows everything about me. He lays his hand on me, the end of verse 5 says. You know, when a child maybe wakes up in the night and he or she is having trouble going to sleep, mom or dad can come in there and just sort of gently pat the child on the back. Maybe rest the hand on his or her back. Or maybe touch the face. And just that warmth, that presence, is able to calm the child. Everything's okay. The psalmist says, you lay your hand on me. Now, how does he react to this knowledge? The fact that God knows everything about me. Verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's beyond my understanding, beyond my comprehension. It's high. I cannot attain it. But you know what? I'm also comforted by that fact. Because if I understood everything like God understands everything, then I guess I would be equal with God. He's God and I'm me. I am the created and He is the creator. And that's the way it's supposed to be. I don't have to know all the answers, all the reasons, because He's got that. And this is too wonderful for me. I get it. I can't understand. God, how can you know everything the way that it's going to work out in the end, but also allow me to have free moral agency to make those decisions in the meantime? I get it. There are things that make my mind explode when I think about God, and I'm sure you're the same way. But at the end of the day, isn't it comforting to know God knows everything? He knows everything about me. But he continues. Beginning at verse 7, we focus in on the fact that God is everywhere, omnipresent. Where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? These seem to be parallel statements, right? To leave God's spirit is to leave God's presence. And notice again, we're not just emphasizing the fact that God is everywhere. It's personal. And so God knows everything, and He knows everything about me. And God is everywhere, and He's everywhere that I am or will be. He says, where can I go that you are not? Where shall I flee from your presence? Now, the fact that God is omnipresent does not stop man from trying to hide from God, does it? It's been that way since the fall. You go back to Genesis chapter 3, after Adam and Eve have eaten the forbidden fruit and thus sinned against God. And the text says that they hear God coming in the cool of the day. I don't understand what that means, but whatever. They hear God coming and they try and hide themselves. Where are you, Adam? God never asks questions for information. God only asks questions for contemplation. He's trying to get Adam to see, don't you see where your sin has led you? Don't you see the separation that sin causes? How you don't any longer want to be in my presence. You want to be away from my presence. Think about Jonah. God, I don't really feel like going to Nineveh. First ticket to Tarsus. Here we come. In the belly of a fish, praying. And we talk about that in children's Bible classes. Can you imagine the smell of being inside a big fish? You haven't eaten dinner yet, right? Jonah was humbled, but even still, he could not get the hatred of the people of Nineveh out of his heart to rejoice when God forgave them. Read to the end of the book. That's the part we don't often discuss in Sunday school. People have tried to hide from God, but here the psalmist says, listen, it doesn't matter where I go. If I ascend to heaven, verse 8, you're there. See, nowhere is off limits to God. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. All right, here's the idea. If I ascend to heaven, the highest point that I could go, or if I descend to Sheol, this is the Hebrew equivalent of the Greek term Hades, the Hadean realm, the realm of disembodied spirits. The place where your soul goes at death to await the final judgment. The Bible tells us, for example, in Acts chapter 2, Peter, quoting the Davidic messianic prophecy, refers to how Jesus went down to the grave. He went to Hades, The King James Version translated it hell, which leaves us this weird impression. We're not talking about Jesus going to the eternal place of destruction. No, Jesus didn't go there. Jesus went to the Hadean realm, where all disembodied spirits go. And when he was resurrected, it seems that his soul must have come from there, reuniting with the body and then going forth. Jesus says in the book of Revelation that he has the keys of Hades and death. And that's the reason why he can say, I am the resurrection and the life. But look at the picture that the psalmist is painting with that background in mind. If I ascend to heaven, you're there. And if I descend, when someone passes, typically their body is buried. If I go as far into the ground as I can go, remember what Jesus said, by the way, to the believing thief on the cross? This day you will be with me in paradise. See, even in death, the faithful Christian is not alone. If I take the wings of the morning, seems to be a figurative expression for going as far east as I can go. You know, where the sun rises, the wings of the morning. And if I dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, from Palestine, the sea would have been to the west. Okay, so if I go as far east as I can go, the wings of the morning, you're there. If I go as far west as I can go, God, you are there. Even there, your right hand shall lead me. Your right hand shall hold me, help me, grasp me, sustain me. Near the end of 2020 or the beginning of 2021, I read an article in the Christian Chronicle about Victor Glover, an astronaut who was preparing, at least at the time the article was written, to go and be on the International Space Station for 6 months. Glover is a member of the Lord's Church, and thus the Chronicle was interviewing him about what he was anticipating. He described how among the things that he was packing for his little trip, he was going to take enough supplies so that he could regularly, that is, each first day of the week, participate in the Lord's Supper. And he was going to take his Bible with him too. He said that thanks to 2020, he was already used to worshiping virtually, and he was anticipating having a good internet connection on the International Space Station. So he was planning to tune in to one of three congregations every Sunday to not only participate in worship from space, but also, of course, to continually observe the first day of the week. Isn't that neat? As far as it's humanly possible to go, God is there. God is everywhere I am or will be. If I say, verse 11, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. I think he's talking about the darkness that comes sometimes in life, the trials, the difficulties. In fact, the word cover here in verse 11 is used three other times in the Old Testament, one of which is Genesis 3:15, the very first messianic prophecy, when God says to the serpent about Jesus, he will crush your head. It's the same Hebrew term, I think, that's used here in this psalm. The idea being, in those moments of life when I feel that life is just covered over me, when I feel that it's one wave crashing on me after another, and I don't have the time to pick myself back up, in those moments where the darkness just crushes me, even then, the night is bright as the day. Darkness is as light with you. Has your experience been like mine when you're physically sick? Nighttime seems to be the hardest when you're sick at home. During the day, maybe you start feeling a little better. You watch all the daytime TV that you can possibly handle. And then at night, you're trying to lie flat and go to sleep, and all the symptoms return, and it's just hard. Some of you know about our son, Owen. When he was born, he had a few difficulties early on. He was born at 2-ish in the morning, a few minutes after 2. He started coming before any of us realized that he was on his way, and so we didn't have family in town or anything. We found ourselves at 4 a.m., Owen having been whisked away to the NICU, just staring at each other like, well, what do we do now? To which the nurse replied, just try and get some sleep. Okay. I guess if I were her, I probably would have said the same thing. What do you say? But there wasn't anyone that we felt we could pick up the phone and call. I mean, we knew people would answer if we called, but you don't want to interrupt their sleep. Nighttime sometimes feels lonely. The darkness just crushes you. And here the psalmist says, to God, the darkness is like light. God can see right through it to come and rescue me, to help me through this darkness. You know, the wonderful 23rd Psalm, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'm not going to get hung up here. I'm not going to be here forever. God is going to bring me through this. And even then, he says, you're with me. Here, the psalmist says, God is everywhere I am or will be. Picking up at verse 13 then, we find that God is omnipotent. That is to say, God is all-powerful. You formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. Let's pause there a moment and notice, right? God is all-powerful. He can do anything. And here, specifically, David highlights once again the personal aspect of God's omnipotence by saying, God is all-powerful and I am His. I'm His. You want to talk about a couple of verses that are relevant to a lot of conversation that's taking place in our culture this week and last week? You formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. When I was in my most secret condition, you know, it takes special technology to get a peek at that baby that's inside there. I can't just look and see the child. There needs to be something special that's done to help me see that. The Cosby family recently got the 4D imagery, right? Which is amazing these days. You don't have to look at that black and white thing anymore where the doctor says, well, this is a foot, and you stand there and say, uh-huh, I'm sure it is. It's like, is this one of those psychological tests? What do you see now? Okay. No, but they flip this switch, and all of a sudden you're seeing nose and a mouth and eyes if the baby is cooperating. Everything is there. And you think, even inside, look at what God is doing. This is the reason why we're pro-life. This is the reason why we value the life that's inside the womb, because it's just that, it's life. That's a person in there. He or she has a beating heart and eyes and a nose and a mouth and the whole thing. He or she can feel pain and respond to it. Here, the psalmist alludes to that fact. Even when I was in my most secret condition, God, you were powerfully forming me. And so I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. Wait a minute, in context, he's talking about his body. You formed me when I was in the womb. It's David's body, but it's the work of God, he says. I ought to be really careful with that child in there. He or she is the work of God. My frame, verse 15, was not hidden from you. See, as the Christian Standard Bible says, my bones were not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. This intricately woven, is a term that has to do with complex patterns and colors of a weaver, of embroidery. And it gives us this idea of, here's an artist, someone who's working with his or her hands and bringing all of these different tapestries and colors and things together. And then finally the time comes when they can present it into the open and we can all admire this work of art. And here the psalmist describes God like that, intricately weaving together these parts, deep concealment in the mother's womb, and then the work of art emerges. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. The NIV says, my unformed body. We're talking about an incomplete vessel, talking about the process of gestation. And even as that child is growing inside the mother's womb, God saw us before there was anything really to be seen. And His power was forming us. My body, my choice. No. No. My body for His glory. My body for His purposes. My body given to me to steward for a period of time while I'm here on this earth to do His will. He gave it to me. In Him I live and move and have my very being. God is all powerful and I belong to Him. How precious, verse 17, to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I'd count them, they're more than the sand. I awake and I'm still with you. It's almost as if David is saying, I'm trying to stretch myself by thinking my thoughts with you, God. And it's almost exhausting to do that. And maybe some have wondered, maybe the psalmist is saying, and I fall asleep in the process, and when I awake, you're still right there, and all your thoughts are still there, and they're like the sand on the seashore. I'm yours. Finally, in verses 19 through the end, the emphasis is on God's holiness. God is all holy. And the personal aspect of this that the psalmist is about to make is, God is all holy, and I want to be holy too, because I want to be with Him. We have a little bit of a shift here, because now David is going to begin to address those who would set themselves at odds with God or with His people. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Spurgeon comments in his notes on the Psalms, the Treasury of David, and he says that those who would commit crimes against God, those who would sin against God, do so in His very face. And that's true. If God is all-knowing, and He is, certainly God sees the sins that are committed, the wickedness that can come from human beings. Oh, that you would slay the wicked. Oh, men of blood, violent men, depart from me. David says, I don't want to be anywhere near these individuals who are unrighteous, who are unholy. Get away from me. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? He continues in the rest of the verse, do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies. Look how personal this is for David. I want to be singularly devoted to God, such that those who would hate God, well, they're going to find themselves at odds with me as well. You know, there's a sense of this that is certainly commendable. The singularness of David, the fact that David is willing to say, listen, God, I love what you love, and I hate what you hate, and I'm going to fight for you, God. When we come to the New Testament age, we know that Jesus gives us an ethic to guide us in this way. That we're not to seek personal vengeance, but to leave that with God, because vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay, Romans chapter 12. We know that Jesus will tell us to love our enemies and to do good to those who hate us and would spitefully use us and persecute us for His name's sake. I'm not to necessarily take up arms in defending God. Of course, David, in David's time, being the king of God's chosen people, well, what the nation of Israel did in many ways represented God to those people around them. David lived in different circumstances. At the same time, David's single devotion to God is something that I can take and apply to myself. For example, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, what relationship has righteousness with lawlessness? What relationship has light with darkness? What relationship has the children of God with Belial? I don't want to be anywhere a part of unequally yoking together that which is holy and that which is profane. And David teaches us that here. As easy as it is to point the fingers, though, in the concluding verses of this psalm, David turns it around on himself. He places himself in the crucible in verses 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Now, of course, the psalmist is confident that God is going to do that. In fact, backing up to verse 1, he says, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. He's fully aware of the fact that God knows everything about him. But here he invites that. No doubt for the purpose of purification. I want you to expose the areas that need to be exposed so that I can be right in your sight. So we can have a relationship. So there's nothing that's hindering my devotion to you. Try me and know my thoughts. Even the disturbing thoughts, even the disquieting thoughts, the cares of my life. God, I want you to know those and to help me through those and see if there's in any grievous way in me and lead me by contrast into the way everlasting or into the ancient way. God, I want to be holy too. And I need your help. Not only to expose what is profane in me, but then to guide me into righteous living. Just like that, he concludes this psalm. Four things that the psalmist recalled about God in a very personal way. God, you know everything. You know everything about me. God, you're everywhere. You're everywhere I am and everywhere I will be. God, you're all powerful and I'm yours. You formed me. God, you're all holy and I want to be holy too. There's nowhere that you can go. Doesn't matter who you're around, doesn't matter what your job might be. There's nowhere you can go that God isn't. And there's nothing that can or will happen to you in this life that will take God by surprise. And so the focus that we need to have is, God, you know it all anyway. You're everywhere. You're powerful enough to deal with this. Even the darkness is like light to you. And so, God, may I just be holy. May I bear up under these trials in a holy, righteous way. May I be yours. May I be pure in your sight. We are truly never alone. This evening, if there's any aspect of what we've discussed about the nature of God that you feel in your heart you're trying to conceal from God, as I said a moment ago, that could be a red flag. Something may be spiritually amiss in your life. And it could be that a private change is necessary, but it could be that leaning on church family and asking for prayers, even tonight, would be a healthy thing to help you in your relationship with God. And if we can help you, we'd love to do it. It could be this evening that you feel estranged from God because you don't have a relationship with Him. You can't call Him your Father because you're not yet His child. You haven't been adopted into His family by virtue of the blood of Jesus. And if that's the case tonight, don't wait. Let's understand what we're doing, absolutely. Turn from sin, confessing His name, putting our faith in Him, and let's be immersed in water for the remission and forgiveness of your sins. Isn't it wonderful to be together? We're going to sing this song to encourage each other. If you have a need, we're praying you'll come. so we can support you, cheer you on, and rejoice with you while we stand in